From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's archive edition, Smoking, the story of smuggled documents, corporate secrets, and ambiguous science, as told in the now infamous Brown and Williamson tobacco papers. New York Times science writer Philip Hiltz broke the story on the secret documents and wrote about the papers in his book Smokescreen. Also, Christopher Buckley, his novel Thank You for Smoking, satirized tobacco executives and anti-smoking activists. And we remember conductor, arranger, and songwriter Paul Weston, who died last week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it's Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's responsibility to stop the violence that has resulted in 8 more deaths in Jerusalem and the West Bank.
What I've said to Chairman Arafat is that we must get things back on track. He must give clear instructions to his security forces to cease and desist from these violent attacks. He has to start keeping order against terrorists and not firing weapons against Israeli soldiers. He must stop the incitement. He must personally intervene and stop the incitement.
Netanyahu rejects the Palestinian claim that Israel's opening of a tunnel near a Muslim holy site touched off the violence. He says Arafat incited the riots. UN officials say they're pursuing peace efforts in Afghanistan, where fundamentalist Islamic rebels have taken over the capital. The city of Kabul fell to the rebels early today after 2 days of fighting with the forces of a coalition government. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
A UN official in charge of Afghan affairs says the UN is trying to increase contact with all of the factions involved in Afghanistan's civil war. That includes the Taliban rebels who have seized the capital. Kayataka Kawabata, who's in the Political Affairs Office of the UN, says reports from Afghanistan indicate the city of Kabul is calm today, with the rebels firmly in control. Kawabata says leaders of the coalition government who retreated from the city are reported to be heading to the northeast. That's the stronghold of their Tajik ethnic group. The UN espouses a negotiated settlement in Afghanistan, but the Taliban previously has refused to talk peace with other faction leaders. The Taliban says the other leaders are corrupt and do not adhere to strict Islamic law. I'm Vicky O'Hara in Washington.
One of the nation's largest forestry companies, Weyerhaeuser, is facing a criminal investigation over its handling of a toxic chemical leak 2 years ago. Steve Kruger of member station KPLU reports.
No one was hurt when about 5,000 pounds of chlorine gas leaked from the Weyerhaeuser paper mill at Longview in southwestern Washington state in 1994. The chemical is extremely toxic and can cause anyone breathing it to pass out within seconds. The Environmental Protection Agency wants to know why the company waited 21 hours before it advised emergency officials the leak had occurred. The EPA has already levied a $225,000 civil fine against the company because of the delay. Now investigators want to know if Weyerhaeuser delayed the notification because of a criminal intent to conceal the problem. Weyerhaeuser officials deny any criminal wrongdoing and say they intend to cooperate with the EPA investigation. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Kruger in Seattle.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 13 points, but the NASDAQ Composite Index is up 2.5. This is NPR. ValueJet Airlines' planned return to the air Monday could be bumpy. The union representing flight attendants says it may file suit to keep the discount carrier grounded. A spokeswoman for the union charges that the company has an abysmal safety record under its current leadership. As walkouts by symphony musicians continue in several U.S. cities, members of the Oregon Symphony Orchestra have ended their strike by approving a new contract. Scott Schlegel of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
Oregon Symphony musicians ratified the contract by a vote of 56-22, sending a strong message to symphony management that many musicians are still unhappy with the compensation they'll receive for an increased number of performances. The new contract raises salaries 6.5% over the next 3 years, with an additional 3% raise in the fourth year. Negotiator and principal trumpet player Fred Sauter said musicians are challenging management to increase concert ticket sales.
The orchestra is already in a very challenging mood, And if something doesn't occur in that direction, I would imagine there would be quite a reaction.
The agreement includes potentially lucrative revenue sharing, unusual among symphony contracts, that would share up to $100,000 in ticket revenues. For National Public Radio, I'm Scott Schlegel in Portland.
A hot air balloon went out of control near Phoenix this morning. It touched down and lifted off along a busy highway several times. More than half of the dozen people aboard were injured, one critically, before the balloon finally came to rest. Congressional and White House negotiators have resumed their work after just a few hours of sleep as they try to reach budget compromises before the start of the new fiscal year next Tuesday. The disputed areas range from food safety to aid for the poor. Lawmakers have another incentive to wrap up a budget deal this weekend. They're eager to get back to their districts to campaign, with Election Day just a few weeks away. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, and on this archive edition, the subject is smoking. Yesterday, the Center for Disease Control issued a report on smoking and teenagers, which found that since 1991, smoking has increased among all teens, regardless of age, gender, or race. It was only 2 years ago that the heads of seven U.S. tobacco companies swore to a congressional committee that nicotine and cigarettes are not addictive. Philip Hiltz covered the story for the New York Times, where he's a health and health policy reporter. Shortly after that story was published, he was leaked the secret documents that have become known as the tobacco papers. These papers revealed that tobacco executives intentionally covered up the results of experiments that showed the damaging effects of smoking. I spoke with Hiltz last spring after the publication of his book, Smokescreen: The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. I asked him to describe the tobacco papers that were leaked to him in 1994.
These were about 4,000 pages of material from inside the companies, inside Brown & Williamson Tobacco Corporation in Louisville. They were memos from one executive to another, from one research scientist to another inside the company, studies that they had done. These were papers that the company was looking at. They were in court. This is the paper start in about 1957, and they run to about 1991. They were in court, and the plaintiffs were asking for papers continuously during this time. And the company had to sort through all the documents they had in their office, that is to say, every stick of paper that they could find over this 30, 40, 50-year period. And so they got together a group of paralegals and lawyers to sift through the documents and find out relevant material. So these papers were the best of those searches.
And how did you become the lucky reporter to get them?
I'm not sure exactly how I was the one picked, but the person who pulled them out of Brown Williamson, this is a fellow named Merrill Williams, an unemployed character at the time, a drama major in college. He was unemployed, and then he picked up this job as a paralegal, and he carried these documents out and gave them to a lawyer, who then gave them to someone in Congress, who then gave them to me. I guess I had been covering tobacco for the New York Times already for 6 months or so at the time and had written a number of stories, and so I guess it seemed like the logical place to go.
What were your responsibilities as a reporter before going public with the story of these papers? What did you have to check out first?
First, I had to look at the papers. In the beginning, they didn't tell me where they came from. They just said, we want you to look at these papers. We're a little nervous about this, and we're not sure what we're going to do, but look at them. So I went through the papers and tried to check, for example, who wrote a memo and what year, and go back and see if that was the right person in that job at that time in the company and so on. So it was kind of internal checks. But the documents from the beginning, it was obviously genuine material. The companies, when I called them and said, I have these papers, they immediately said, yes, these are genuine. In fact, they're stolen. Why don't you give them back?
Yeah, sure. They must have been shocked and quite dismayed when you called and said, we've got the papers.
Yes, I think they were. They were upset, and they said, you can't use these papers. You must bring them back. And then they subpoenaed me. That was May, I guess, of 1994.
And your reaction to the subpoena?
Well, it's fairly normal in newspapers for these kind of things to happen. It was kind of stimulating in a way. I got more and more interested as they got more and more upset because it meant to me that we were getting somewhere. This was stuff that they cared about. It's kind of exciting.
What would you sum up as the most damning information in the documents?
In all of the documents, that's the Brown Williamson ones plus others we've had since, I think the most damning material is about children. I think the main subject about tobacco is children and how the companies behave toward children. And there are documents which talk about marketing to 12-year-olds. There are documents which talk about sitting 16-year-olds down and interviewing them at great length about what ads they like and what cigarettes they smoke and why they smoke and whether they're thinking of quitting and what they could do to prevent them from quitting and so on. I think these are the things that are most damaging.
What did companies do to market to 12-year-olds?
Documents show that their greatest concern is from age 12 to about age 17. This is the time when kids are just forming up their own image of themselves. They're in their own heads, they're making an idea for themselves of who they will be. And they pick up a certain kind of clothing, a certain kind of music, and so on. And at that same time, they're being offered cigarettes, essentially, in the convenience stores where they go in to buy sodas and whatnot. There are Joe Camel and there's Marlboro Man and so on. And these things are pitched directly to them. T-shirts with the logos on them, caps, lighters, paraphernalia of various kinds. And they take these promotional items and they put them in the stores nearest the junior high schools and high schools. And they advertise in the magazines and newspapers that the kids read that have high youth readership, for example, Rolling Stone or Sports Illustrated is a big one, and so on. These are the various kinds of tactics they use.
My guest is Philip Hiltz, the New York Times longtime health and science policy correspondent. His new book is called Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. Let's go back to 1953. This is a year that the top heads of most of the cigarette companies gathered in one place for an unprecedented meeting. And this meeting was in response to some damning scientific research. What was the research that provoked this meeting?
There were two things that happened in 1952 and 1953. The first was they discovered that they did a study of British doctors, and they found that there was a very high rate of lung cancer among men who smoked, and it went up directly as a relation to the number of cigarettes you smoke. You smoke half a pack, there's a certain amount of additional lung cancers. You smoke a pack, it's twice as much, and it keeps going up like that. So it was fairly clear that tobacco was the thing causing this big outbreak of lung cancers. And then in 1953, Ernst Winder, a scientist here in the U.S., took the tobacco tars out of smoke and painted them on the backs of mice. And this produced a huge number of tumors, so that you had the statistical evidence that there was a connection, and then you had the physical evidence that this tar could cause tumors on real skin. And these two things together made it clear that cigarettes were really quite hazardous, much more hazardous than anyone had thought. The Winder story was also the first time that the hazards of smoking had been on the front pages of the newspapers. So within a week after that story about the painting on the backs of the mice, the top executives of the companies met at the Plaza Hotel in New York to lay a plan what to do about it.
What was their plan?
The plan was denial. They thought, we could admit this and we could go ahead and accept some kind of regulation, but let's not do that. Let's first find out what we can on our own in our own labs. Maybe we can even fix the hazard and not have to talk about it. We could just find out what is the thing in tobacco that's causing this problem and take it out, and then cigarettes will be okay. So in the meanwhile, what we will do is we'll deny it. We'll say there's no problem with cigarettes, and we'll launch a program, what they called Entirely Pro-Cigarettes Program. That is to say, they would have PR efforts, they would have scientific research, in theory scientific research, push this year after year that there was no problem. The cigarettes and the disease were not necessarily connected. It was just a statistical quirk and so on. While at the same time, they were saying that in their own labs, they were working on what the hazard was and how to get rid of it.
It was at this meeting that the Tobacco Industry Research Committee was born, and this is basically the forerunner of the Tobacco Institute, which became the major PR and lobbying arm.
Yes, there are two outfits out there now. Yeah, the Council for Tobacco Research and the Tobacco Institute. The Tobacco Institute is a political arm in Washington. The CTR is in New York, and it's the scientific end. They founded the TIRC after they had run a full-page ad in 400 newspapers around the country saying, well, we've heard that there is this hazard, so we're going to investigate it ourselves, and we'll tell you what we come up with. So they established this research group, and they were, at least as far as the public was concerned, they were going to research the question of health and tobacco and what whether this was really a problem or not. In fact, it was only a front. They didn't do any tobacco and health research. They did a good deal of research on other topics, but none of it on tobacco and health.
And they needed to find doctors who were willing to say that cigarettes and cancer were indirectly linked. And they managed to find a retired founder of the National Cancer Institute who was perfectly happy to say that and who believed it, too.
Yes, Clarence Cook Little. I'm not sure what he believed in the end, but his thing in life was the genetics of cancer. And he thought cancer was pretty much going to be predetermined by your own genes. If you have a certain kind of defect, you'll get this kind of cancer. If you have another kind of defect, you get another kind. So that he thought, well, there are people predisposed to smoking and to cancer, I mean, from smoking, so that the smoking itself is not the problem. It's your own genes that are the problem. He built a big laboratory based on those ideas of genetics and cancer. And so when they came along and asked him, will you come and work with us on this subject, he said, yes, I believe that environmental factors and cancer are really not very important. I think it's really our own genes that are the problem, and we don't need to worry about the environment.
I thought it was interesting that much of the response to the damning scientific research that was being done, much of the response in 1953 was dreamed up by a public relations committee. And what you point out was still a very new business. Public relations was really getting started in the 1950s, modern public relations.
That's right. The companies being very profitable, I mean, they have a lot of extra money that other industries don't have, are the ones who get into these things first. For example, advertising. The tobacco industry developed advertising in the United States. They were the first ones in there. And then when PR came along, the idea of PR in the early 1950s, they were there, and they made use of it more than anyone else. You could say that they really sort of started the PR industry. The PR outfit in this case was Hill & Knowlton, and John Hill was the head of it, the founder of it, and he worked with the tobacco companies.
You say one of the things that that the tobacco industry came up with was dirty tricks, campaigns to undermine the credibility of adversaries. What did they come up with?
They did quite a few different things. They had an intelligence network, and whenever they found a scientist was going to speak on the topic, he had done a research study and he was going to talk about it, they would send somebody to argue with him in scientific meetings. There was one person who did some work for them named Freddie Homburger, and he did a research study about the effect of smoking on of animals who breathe in the smoke from tobacco and whether it would cause tumors. It was thought that it wouldn't show up any tumors because animals have different systems for breathing than we do. They're nose breathers, for example, so you wouldn't have the same kind of problem in the lungs because the particles are all pulled out. But it did show up. There were quite a few cancers of the larynx and the lungs and whatnot in these animals. And so he was going to announce this at a press conference. And the companies found out about it ahead of time. They went to his house. They said, we're pulling your funding. You can't do any more of this work. And in fact, we have the right to edit your work. So we're going to strike out the word cancer in each place where you mention it in your paper. And this press conference, he thought he was going to hold it still. He went to the meeting. He went to the press conference, and there was no one there. They had canceled it without his knowing.
Hmm.
It's that sort of business.
My guest is Philip Hiltz, health and science policy correspondent for The New York Times and author of the new book Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. back with Philip Hiltz, the New York Times reporter who broke the story of the secret tobacco industry papers. He's also the author of the new book, Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. While the tobacco industry was publicly denying that smoking was hazardous to the health of smokers, it was sponsoring research inside the industry to find out what the offending chemicals were in cigarettes, that the cigarette industry can remove those chemicals and basically offer safer cigarettes. What kind of research were they conducting to find out what the offensive materials were?
It was a full range of laboratory research, testing on animals, testing in the lungs, testing, painting on the backs like Ernst Winder had done, and so on, to see the relationship between the tumors and the smoke. There were also things on heart disease. Various kinds of questions were brought up. How exactly does the smoke cause the disease, cause each different kind of disease? So they did a huge amount of research, more than anyone on the outside. And what they discovered was that it wasn't one substance involved. It wasn't two or five or ten. It was hundreds of different substances that are toxic, and they wouldn't be able to take them out. They could filter a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but fundamentally the hazard comes from burning these substances. They produce carcinogenic substances when you burn the leaves. So you take one out, you still have 12 left. It was a real problem for them. And so it turned out that they would have to completely redesign cigarettes, take out the tobacco completely, or make it so that they don't burn but just heat up the tobacco or something, some completely radical procedure if they were going to make them safer. And they made those designs, but then they put them on the shelf.
I think one of the strangest responses that you reprint from transcripts in your book, Smokescreen, happened in 1988? Tobacco case, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the head of the Liggett Tobacco Company was on the stand, and he was being asked about research that the company had sponsored, in which they found that the elements in cigarettes were causing tumors on mice. And he said that they were really conducting these experiments to try to reduce the tumors on the backs of mice.
Right. And he was asked, you mean this has nothing to do with humans? It has to do with mice only? You're really working on spending all this money, a couple million dollars or whatever, just to save mice from their tumors? And he said, yes. That's the problem that the companies have, is that they know all these things. And in private, sometimes they'll answer honestly. But in public, they believe that if they tell what's actually gone on, they'll be open to suits and they'll lose the suits. So in public, they have to say they don't know, or they have to mislead in one way or another.
Now, in the early days of the low-tar cigarette, the companies kept nicotine levels high, even though they were removing tars, and they could have removed nicotine.
Yes, the level is important. It's not so much that it has to be high. It has to be just enough. It has to be enough so the smoker gets what he needs in the way of a hit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a drug effect. You're kind of dosing yourself. And so if you have it too high, it gets too harsh. People don't like that, except in some countries. There are some European countries that have very high nicotine. But the people in this country like a kind of a moderate amount. And they've found the physical range, the exact numbers of what range you have to have this in order to satisfy smokers. It gets below that, they stop smoking. They go to another cigarette. Gets above that, it gets too harsh. They change cigarettes.
So they had to figure out a process by which they could keep the tar low, but the nicotine at the level that smokers wanted and needed the nicotine.
Right. As they were dropping the tar, the nicotine came down with it. Traditionally, that's the way it worked. If you pull out the tar, you use lighter tobaccos, the nicotine goes down. So they had to pull these two things apart, essentially. They let the tar drop down and keep the nicotine up at a level where people cared about it.
How did they do that?
There are various systems. One is to use ammonia, for example. You dose it a little bit with ammonia, and that frees up the nicotine that's in the cigarette so that a greater percentage of it goes from the tobacco to your lungs. There are these kind of tactics that are used.
You say that early on in this period when they were trying to separate the level of tar and nicotine, that they would try squirting more nicotine onto tobacco leaves, but that never worked very well.
No, that got it too harsh because if you taste nicotine, it doesn't really have a taste. It has this very nasty acid-like impact on the back of your throat. And that's the problem with having too much. So you have to mix it up and balance it. It's like making a fine wine, really. You have to balance these tastes and feel in the mouth. And when they just squirt the nicotine directly on, that was too much.
Now, you write about the FDA uncovering the tobacco industry's pursuit of super nicotine tobacco. What's that about?
Yes, this is another tactic they used. This is Brown and Williamson Company trying to have a very high nicotine tobacco so that when you drop the tar down, you still have enough nicotine in the cigarette. So they made this tobacco. They grew up this tobacco. They bred it, actually, genetically, so that instead of 2% or 4% nicotine, they had 6 or 7% nicotine in the leaves. Well, actually, it turns out that for one reason or another in the history, you can't grow high nicotine tobacco in the United States. It's illegal. So they shipped it to Brazil. They shipped the seeds there, and they grew it up there, and then they shipped the tobacco back into the United States. And this was something that is, in fact, it's illegal, and they're right now going into court on smuggling charges because they smuggled the seeds out and the tobacco back. But this was another one of those tactics to keep the nicotine level up as the tar was dropping down. And the FDA got onto their trail, and they found the company that had done the basic biological research and actually made the seeds and so on and tracked it back that way.
Philip Hiltz is a New York Times reporter and author of the book Smokescreen. Our interview was recorded last spring. More on smoking in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Like a cigarette, I never knew the thrill of life until I touched your lips. Then, just like a cigarette, love seemed to fade away and leave behind ashes of regret. Then with a flip of your fingertips, it was easy for you to forget. Oh, love is like a cigarette.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Two cigarettes in the dark.
Coming up, Philip Hiltz talks about developing a safer cigarette. Christopher Buckley satirizes tobacco public relations experts and anti-smoking activists. And we remember conductor, arranger, and songwriter Paul Weston.
My sweetheart, two silhouettes in a room, almost obscured by the gloom. We were so close, yet so far apart. It happened that I stumbled in upon their rendezvous. I heard my sweetheart whispering, I love you, you know that. that I do to.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with New York Times reporter Philip Hiltz. His recent book, Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up, is largely based on the tobacco papers, secret internal documents from the Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company that were leaked to Hiltz. You say by 1975, five tobacco companies had designed and tested successful, safer cigarettes. But the companies couldn't afford to offer those cigarettes, so the companies put the designs in the closet. Why couldn't they market these safer cigarettes?
Probably they could have, but they were afraid. Their lawyers told them that if they put a safer cigarette on the market, when they say safer, of course, that means the other things they were making are dangerous. And they were not about to admit that everything they were making was dangerous and that they had been doing this all the way along. So they were afraid the admission they would make just by putting it on the market. So they never did. And this is still a major issue. There are no safer cigarettes out there now because of that, even though all the companies have them on the shelf.
Will there be a so-called safer cigarette on the market soon, do you think?
I don't know. It's if the companies are regulated, if the president and the FDA succeed in putting some kind of regulations on the company, then they may be free to go ahead and put out a safer cigarette, in which case they probably will, and it should have a significant impact. In fact, I think this may be the future of tobacco if you have a completely different kind of cigarette that has the taste and some nicotine, but is maybe one-tenth as hazardous, because 10% of the lung tumors or whatnot.
Tell us what you know about the safer cigarette, how it compares to a regular cigarette.
There is one that is now being manufactured but not sold by the R.J. Reynolds Company. And it's essentially heating up the tobacco rather than burning it. So then in the front end, you light a little piece of charcoal. You can't see it because it's in the inside the cigarette paper. But when you light the cigarette, the charcoal gets lit. And the charcoal acts like a coal, just like a charcoal briquette on your barbecue. It heats up, and then the hot air goes through and picks up the nicotine and the flavor from the tobacco and comes out the other side, so that it's about half as hot. It's not burning, so you don't get all the carcinogens. You get a much lower number of them, so that presumably it's somewhat safer, although we haven't actually tested it. Again, the way you test it, of course, is let people smoke for 20 years and then find out what's going on.
So if it's not actually burning, are you not inhaling smoke?
You're inhaling a lot less smoke and a different kind of smoke. The composition of the smoke is quite different. It's more water and glycerin and so on, products that are lifted out of the tobacco by the warmth of the air passing by. So it's really quite different. And in fact, the end of the cigarette, very little smoke comes off it. I've been in a room with someone smoking one of these things, and you couldn't tell that somebody was smoking in the room because it's very, very light smoke.
Have you tried one yourself?
I have. This was in North Carolina when I first went down to see what they were doing with them. I used to smoke myself for 10 years, and I liked it, but I quit because of health problems. My wife was pregnant and asked me to quit with her, and we did. But since I had smoked, I thought it would be kind of interesting to taste these things. They're actually pretty good. They taste pretty much like a cigarette.
You said that you think one of the true casualties in this story of the tobacco industry is the cigarette itself. What do you mean by that?
Well, as I said before, I did smoke myself for 10 years, and I liked it. And I liked the flavor of tobacco and the smell of it. But the cigarettes of the old days were real tobacco, cured, wrapped up in paper, and you just light it. It was that simple. Now, the cigarettes are not really tobacco anymore. Only about half of it is tobacco. The other stuff is stuff. In fact, they sweep up junk off the floor and dump it into the cigarette. There's this reconstituted sheet, they call it. This is the stems are chopped up and mashed and made into a kind of paper, and then they squirt some tobacco juice on it and chop it up to make it look like tobacco, but it's not. It's a kind of a stem paper. So what's in a cigarette is quite different than it used to be.
What's the purpose of using all that other stuff in the cigarette? Is it to save money or what?
It is. That's where they started. They thought, well, we're using, in the beginning, they used only the big, bright leaves in the middle of the tobacco plant. Then they said, well, maybe if we use more leaves, maybe we use the stem, we use the dirt, whatever, we could, you know, this is poundage we can put into the cigarette. So it saved them quite a bit. 10, 20, 30% of the price of a cigarette can be saved by using the junk. You just have to make sure the flavor is still okay. And they do that. They squirt the flavor back on and so on. But it's, you know, it's quite an engineering process now. It's not just chopping down the tobacco and putting it in paper.
Philip Hiltz is a New York Times reporter and author of the book Smokescreen. Our interview was recorded last May. Coming up, Christopher Buckley satirizes tobacco PR execs. This is Fresh Air. Tobacco public relations experts and anti-smoking activists got kicked in the pants by satirist Christopher Buckley in his novel Thank You for Smoking. Buckley is a former speechwriter for George Bush and is the author of the bestseller The White House Mess, a satire of White House memoirs. He's the son of famed conservative writer William F. Buckley. I spoke with Christopher Buckley about Thank You for Smoking when it was published in 1994.
The basic premise of the book is a group of Washington spokesman for dangerous industries. The hero of the book is a guy named Nick Naylor, who, as you might guess from his name, is the chief spokesman for the tobacco industry. His two best friends are a woman named Polly, who's the chief spokeswoman for the liquor industry, which in this case calls itself the Moderation Council, and a fellow named Bobby Jay, who is the chief spokesman for the gun industry, which in this instance calls itself SAFETY, which stands for the Society for the Advancement of Firearms and Effective Training of Youth, formerly the National Right to Bear Arms Committee. And collectively, they call themselves the Mod Squad, which stands for, not for the TV show, but for Merchants of Death. So it's about sort of yuppie, likable, yuppie mass murderers, if you will.
Let's see how your character, Nick, your spokesperson for the cigarette industry, handles himself on The Larry King Show. And your character has basically told Larry King that 96% of heavy smokers never get seriously ill. You want to pick it up from there?
Sure. "Where does that figure come from?" said Larry. "From the National Institutes of Health, right here in Bethesda, Maryland." Nick thought to himself, "Let NIH deny it tomorrow. Tomorrow people would be on to the next thing. Bosnia, tax increases, Sharon Stone's new movie, Patty Davis's latest novel about what a bitch her mother was." As long as he was at it, he threw in, "And from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia." "That is news," Larry shrugged. Larry was basically too polite to accuse his guests of being shameless liars. It was probably why Ross Perot liked him so much. With any luck, no one from NIH or CDC would be watching. "Of course," Nick said, "neither Secretary Furioso nor the Surgeon General, both of whom continue to refuse to debate with me on the issues, want you to know that, or their budgets will go down. Sad, but true." "Interesting," said Larry. "There are a lot of things," Nick sighed, "that the government doesn't want people to know about tobacco, such as," Nick thought to himself, what? "The indisputable scientific fact that it retards the onset of Parkinson's disease." Larry said, "So you're saying we should all wait till we're 65 and then start smoking like crazy?" "Well, Larry, we don't advocate that anyone should take up smoking. We're just here to provide the scientific facts."
Well, thanks for reading that. That's Christopher Buckley reading from his new book, Thank You for Smoking. You've said the inspiration for this book came from watching the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour and watching somebody from the Tobacco Institute defending tobacco. What interested you so much in watching somebody defending smoking? People who are paid to defend it.
Their motivation. I didn't know anyone I went to college with whose ambition was to become the chief spokesman for the tobacco industry, or for that matter, the liquor industry or the gun industry. I wondered how, you know, 30-something, 40-something, you know, attractive yuppies ended up in this, doing this for a living. So I, having decided to write the book, I called them up, and I was mildly disingenuous about what my motives were. I said that I told them I was researching a book on Neo-Puritanism, which Thank You for Smoking also is, and that I wanted to hang out with them and see what it was like to have to, you know, be in the front lines of the of all these anti movements. And their motivation in the end turned out to be a little more prosaic than inspirational. At the end of the second meeting with this cigarette lady, I was dying to ask her, "What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?" Of course, being a sensitive 90s male, I don't talk like that, Terry. So instead I asked her, "What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?" And I remember very clearly, she exhaled her lung full of smoke and shrugged, a very sort of sexy Lauren Bacall shrug, and said, "I'm just paying the mortgage." And thus was born Nick's yuppie Nuremberg defense. I was only paying the mortgage. It was the motivation that interested me.
Was it entertaining for you to try to come up with speeches for Nick to defend the tobacco industry with?
Absolutely. It was actually, though I find writing very hard, this was kind of fun to do. There you are. You're the front man for an industry that kills, 435,000 human beings a year. That's just American human beings. And what do you say, you know, when you go on the Oprah show and you find yourself, you know, on with the, you know, the head of the Anti-Smoking Office of Health and Human Services and the head of Mothers Against Teenage Smoking, and then, uh-oh, what's this? A bald teenager, bald down, including no eyebrows. Turns out he has cancer from smoking. You know, what do you do? It's at that professional, at the technical level, it's a hell of a challenge.
Well, I love what you gave your character to do. I mean, Nick is very funny and can think on his feet. So in the middle of the Oprah show, and you just described all the other guests, he asks for a cigarette. And you want to explain why?
Yeah, Oprah has just given her introduction where she's talked about the 435,000 deaths per year. She's talked about RJR's old Joe Camel promotion, which has hooked millions of American kids. You know, more kids can recognize Old Joe now than do Mickey Mouse. She's introduced all the other guests, all of whom are just, you know, fire-breathing anti-smokers. And then the last one is this poor 19-year-old teenager who's, you know, clearly dying of cancer and has had radiation treatments. And then she introduces Nick, and, you know, all the audience is glowering at him. And so what does Nick do? He pulls out a cigarette and asks and says, "Do you mind if I smoke?" And there's this gasp in the audience, and she says, "You want to smoke?" And he says, "Well, you know, I understand it's traditional to offer the condemned man one last cigarette," and that kind of breaks the ice. And the audience actually, one person in the audience starts to laugh, and then other people in the audience starts to laugh, to the great annoyance of the anti-smokers on the panel.
You've watched all the TV shows with all the smoking industry people defending cigarettes. What's the most incredible or interesting defense that you've heard them give?
Well, the obvious defense is that it's a free country, and 45 million Americans want to smoke. It's a legal product. They ought to be allowed to smoke as long as they don't, you know, blow it into your lungs. Believe it or not, there is some good news about not smoking but nicotine, which the anti-smoking movement doesn't really like to bring up. But in fact, there is strong medical evidence to suggest, As I read in that section of the book, that nicotine retards the onset of Parkinson's. Smokers have a 50% less rate of Alzheimer's disease. They have a 50% less incidence of endometrial cancer. Believe it or not, I mean, I guess God made nicotine for a reason. And so, you know, they could sort of hit it on that angle, but that they can't, you see, because they're a little hamstrung, because you can't make health claims for these things. It would be a little bit ridiculous if they went up before the Waxman Committee and said, well, but look at the evidence about smoking and Parkinson's disease. You know, there'd be loud guffaws from the back of the room. So I guess I guess they're stuck with, it's a legal product. 45 million Americans want to smoke under the Constitution of the United States, you know, under the tenets of Adam Smith. Someone's going to supply them with that tobacco. Why not us?
Christopher Buckley, recruited in 1994 after the publication of his novel, Thank You for Smoking. Coming up, we remember arranger and songwriter Paul Weston. This is Fresh Air.
Should go around weeping. I should care. I should go without sleeping.
That's Frank Sinatra's 1945 recording of I Should Care, co-composed by Paul Weston, who also co-wrote Day by Day. Weston died last Friday at the age of 84. He arranged for the Tommy Dorsey Band in the late 30s. He was Capitol Records music director in the 40s, and then moved to Columbia Records, where he worked with Doris Day, Rosemary Clooney, and Frankie Lane. Weston is survived by his wife, Jo Stafford, the wonderful singer who often collaborated with Weston. They met in the 30s when she sang with the group the Pied Pipers, which backed up Sinatra in his days with the Dorsey Band. I spoke with Paul Weston and Joe Stafford in 1988 after they reissued a collection of their comedic recordings in their alter egos as Jonathan and Darlene Edwards.
One of the songs that you do is Alabama Bound, and it features you singing accompanied by a chorus of overzealous, overenthusiastic male singers.
Well, we did that as a sort of a put-on of the Mitch Miller sing-along. And the idea with these singers that backed us up, they were some of the best singers in town. And we just told them to be, you know, they sang very well, but a little, maybe a teensy bit over-enthusiastic. And, but actually, they did their parts quite nicely, I thought.
I thought this record might be somehow a tribute to Mitch Miller. Now, this is interesting. You'd both worked at Columbia Records, where Mitch Miller was the head of Artisan Repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
How did he take to this little tribute?
We just never asked him.
And we've never heard.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
the first time that you performed together as Jonathan and Darlene?
I would play piano at parties, you know, after Johnny Green and David Rose and everyone else had finished playing well. I would just play for the fun of it and play like Jonathan. And Joe became Darlene at the end of record sessions when Mitch Miller would send us out some junk to record and the guys in the band, and Joe hated it so much that she would do it as Darlene at the end of the session.
Just as a kind of a way to put down the song that we all hated anyway, just for fun.
So I could see how this tribute to Mitch Miller might have had a real special magic for you under the circumstances.
Boy, you hit it right on the button.
Joe Stafford, let me ask you a few questions about your real self. You had many very popular records during the Second World War. How were you choosing your material then? Did you especially look for records that you thought could really have an extra special meaning to people who were separated during the war?
Well, I think the songs that the songwriters wrote took care of that. You know, there were some great songwriters then, and I think that the times during the war years, I mean, the time sort of dictated the content of the material, and it was there, ready made.
What kind of stories did you hear from people during the war and then after the war about what your songs meant to them, the kind of sentimental meaning the songs took on?
Oh, a great deal. As a matter of fact, I still get them. I still get letters saying, I first heard you at such and such a time during the war in someplace in the Pacific or flying over Europe. I still get them. And yes, many of the songs meant a great deal to them and to me. And I was often like the go-between between this fellow and his girl. And what I was singing was, quote, their song, unquote.
Paul Weston, I have a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
When you started to arrange for Capitol Records, you came up with a new sound that got the name of mood music. Describe the sound that you were working with.
Well, what I did in my mood music was to take and add strings to a dance band sound. I, you know, deeply resented later when it deteriorated into what they call elevator music, because we had great soloists, Eddie Miller and Matty Matlock and Ziggy Elman, on all those albums, and we, you know, kept a jazz feel. I enjoyed it because we were the first, at that time only Castellanets was doing a similar kind of music, but more on a classical scale. And it was fun sort of starting a trend.
When rock and roll started making it onto the charts in the 1950s, did that make things difficult for you both?
Well, at that time, I was doing television, and a lot of television besides the recording. And there was a kind of an attempt to get me connected and to try and do some of that material. And it wouldn't work. I couldn't do it. And but my career continued on in television, which at that point was not that much affected by rock and roll. The music on television stayed pretty much the same for a number of years.
I was doing television then as a conductor. And, of course, we had, in the early days, they would have these rock artists as guests. And I did a show with The Doors with Jim Morrison. And
one.
And I did a show with the Mamas and the Papas, but they were called the Big Three at that time.
You know, Joe Stafford, you had a hit of You Belong to Me, and then the Dupree's had a rock and roll version of that years later. I was wondering what you thought of that when that made it onto the charts.
I don't think... I wasn't even aware of that until some kind of a seminar we had in which some young A&R man...
Snuffy Garrett.
Brought it up as a... He was using it as some kind of an example of a style that these people could do if they wanted to. And he made a big speech about this song, You Belong to Me, not realizing that I, who was sitting next to him, had been the first one to record it and had a tremendous hit from it. He didn't even know it.
And he said this song was recorded so many years ago by somebody, you know, as old, you know. And Joe's sitting there next to him.
See the pyramids alone. tropic isle. Just remember, darling, all the while, you belong to me. See the marketplace in old Algiers. Send me photographs and souvenirs. But remember, another dream appears. You belong to me.
Do you record anymore? Either of you?
No, I don't know, huh?
No, the last thing we did was the Jonathan Darlene album. Darlene remembers Duke and Jonathan plays Fats.
Oh, does Darlene continue to perform long after Joe Stafford had retired?
Now, why is that?
It's easier.
It's a lot easier, and you don't have to worry about the perfection I always tried to come up with.
Okay, well, you guys really know how to swing.
Beautiful.
You must take the A train to go to Sugar Hill way up in Harlem. If you miss the A train.
Paul Weston and Joe Stafford recorded in 1988. Weston died last Friday at the age of 84. We'll close our show today with Joe Stafford's recording of a song co-written by Paul Weston, Day by Day. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Sherrock. I'm Terry Gross.
You're making all